Okay. In this lecture, I want to explore the work of two key theorists who wrote in different countries, in different decades, but they shared similar concerns about the role of women in public life. And this lecture is on a short extract from Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, and two short extracts from Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex. Bear in mind as you read these extracts that Woolf was writing in 1929 and de Beauvoir was writing in the 1940s. Also bear in mind that Carter was born in 1940, so her formative years were the 1950s and 60s. So she would have been closer to the world that de Beauvoir and Woolf are writing about than we are. So de Beauvoir and Woolf would have made more sense to Carter than they probably make sense to us. So these critics can be read as commentators on the state of society in the early part of the 20th century. And you know, although lots of social change occurred between 1920 and 1967 when this novel was published, the greatest change to come to women's life, and I know I've been repeating this, but it's really important, would not happen until 1968. And finally, next week, I will tell you all about 1968. So I'm building up the suspense to 1968. And also keep in mind that this novel is situated just at that particular moment before 1968. So let's see what these critics are saying. I'm sure you found the Woolf extract easy to read. Yes, and understand? The Woolf one, not the Beauvoir. Yeah, okay. So I'm not going to spend time summarizing what she says or, you know, repeating what she says. Instead, I want to get straight into a critique of what we need to get out of Woolf and how can we apply Woolf to the magic toy shop. At the beginning of this chapter, Woolf's narrator, it's very important to separate Woolf from her narrator in this essay. Woolf's narrator makes a value judgment based on an assumption. She decides that in order to find answers to her questions about the different positions that men and women occupy in society and culture, she needs to consult books at the British Museum. I'll just add in brackets here that until 1997, the British Library was located in the British Museum. And it's only recently that they moved it out. So when the narrator says she's going to the British Museum, she's actually going to the British Library. That's why she goes there. So, of course, she goes to the library and trying to find from books an answer to the question, why do men and women dwell in different social spheres? Of course, she soon finds out that this assumption was rather naive and somewhat pointless. Her expectation of finding truth, a truth, unadulterated truth, in the British Museum is soon challenged. And as readers, we are left asking a key question. What is it that this narrator is actually looking for? She asks these questions. Why did men drink wine and women water? Why was one sex so prosperous and the other so poor? What effect has poverty on fiction? And what conditions are necessary for the creation of works of art? I think there is a fundamental problem with these questions. The problem resides in this need to uncover universal truths. There is an assumption here that she's going to get to a universal truth about women and men's lives. Transnational, transhistorical truths about women is what the narrator seems to be looking for. Now, the narrator's initial questions seem to imply that she's searching for answers to why women are not offered the same privileges and opportunities as men. And these questions seem to lump all women in one category and men in another. The literature she uncovers does not answer these questions. Indeed, the entries she cites are indicative of the specificities of women's experiences. Look at what she finds under women and poverty. Conditions in the Middle Ages of, a time-specific entry. Habits in the Fiji Islands of, a culture-specific reference. Weaker in moral sense that, an ethical approach. Shakespeare's opinion of, okay, somebody cared. So what she finds in the books is indicative of the complexities of her question. Do you see what I'm getting at? She doesn't find a straightforward answer to this is how women's lives are, and these are the reasons for why they are disadvantaged. These entries are indicative of the complexities of the questions she's asking. Wolf writes that the narrator's questions of why are women poor became 50 questions until the 50 questions leapt frantically into midstream and were carried away. Wolf does not hope to uncover universal truths about women. Her project is to show that the status of women is context-bound and is historically relative. It's important when you read this essay to dissociate the author from the narrator, from the fictional persona that she creates. Because this essay, which begins with a quest for the truth, ends up being an investigation into anger. And that's really where all of this questioning is leading up to. The fictionalization of the essay is one of Wolf's strategies for removing the argument from her own personal feelings towards women and poverty. Notice what she says about angry male authors. When I read what he wrote about women, I thought not of what he was saying, but of himself. When an author argues dispassionately, he thinks only of the argument. And the reader cannot help thinking of the argument too. Here, we see her advocating an objective approach, a stance from whence she can examine the relationship of the sexes without prejudice. So, A Room of One's Own is not Wolf's angry rant against patriarchy. That's really important to note, actually. It's what she attempts to do here is offer an objective investigation into it. That's why she's got this persona who gets all fired up and all angry about it. She recognizes, and that is Wolf, that life for both sexes is arduous, difficult, a perpetual struggle. More than anything, it calls for confidence in oneself. Here, Wolf is contextualizing her reading of the sexes. Life is difficult for men and for women, and we need self-confidence to be able to surmount difficulties. That's all very well, except that according to Wolf, men, over time, have gained their self-confidence by subordinating women. This is how they have achieved the sense of confidence. Self-confidence, the necessary attribute for survival, for social success, has been traditionally a masculine characteristic. And it is achieved when men can see their grandeur reflected through a smaller, less significant woman. That's how she positions her argument to explain the difference in how men and women contribute to social success. The use of mirror imagery becomes effective here. Wolf argues that women have been the mirrors in which men look to confirm their superiority. She says mirrors are essential to heroic action as well as to violence. So what Wolf conveys to us then is not so much an angry, resentful refutation, but more of a stance against this cultural form of subordination. She likens the dominant-subordinate relationship of men to women to fascist regimes, to dictatorships. She says that women are necessary for men's heroic and violent actions, and she provocatively argues that if woman begins to tell the truth, the figure in the looking glass shrinks. His fitness for life is diminished. How is he to go on giving judgment, dressing up, and speechifying at banquets? I love this word. It describes so many people I know. They just speechify all the time. Unless he can see himself at breakfast and at dinner at least twice the size he really is. At this point, I want to pause and think about Magic Toy Shop. This week, I am particularly interested in Uncle Philip. Every week in my reading of the theory, I'll take a different angle on the novel so that by the end you'll have five different interpretations from five different perspectives of the novel. So this week, I'm thinking about Uncle Philip. I'm also thinking my keywords are poverty, anger, and self-confidence. So Uncle Philip, poverty, anger, and self-confidence. Okay? So thinking about Uncle Philip and about what Wolf has just set up for us. Here is a patriarch, a man with seemingly, possibly, no redeeming features. An abuser, a bully, pretty much a flat character. We don't see him evolving much throughout the narrative. Uncle Philip does not change much over the course of the novel. He rarely speaks. We don't know his story. We don't really know his motives, and we witness his cruelty and manipulation of others, but we don't really get to know him. I suggest that one possible reading of Uncle Philip's character is that he represents an archetype. Okay, I'm going to explain what that means. Okay, these are quotes. That's why this slide is heavy, is text heavy. An archetype, you don't need to write them down. You know I'm going to post it online, yeah? An archetype is, according to Latrobe, a universally recognizable element that recurs across all literature and life. Carl Jung is the most famous psychologist who wrote extensively on the idea of the archetype and the reasons why societies create archetypes. Carl Jung called these elements a kind of collective unconscious, something we all share in our collective ideas of the human race, prototypes, rather than something gained from experience. Archetypes are universal in human beings. They result in a deep emotional response for readers. So you have, I'm sure if you've done Gothic at A level, you've got the archetypal villain. You also have archetypes of the benevolent mother, the archetype of... Do you know what I mean by archetypes? Right. So if I show you a picture, you immediately think, oh, I know, this is the archetypal something or other. So if Uncle Philip is the archetypal villain, he is also an archetypal patriarch. And I'm suggesting that Carter's depiction of Uncle Philip, if he is an archetype, is drawn from folklore, because folklore is part of our collective unconscious. That's where she draws this characterization from. And it depends on the reader's collective unconscious for it to be unraveled. Carter is counting on us to get what Uncle Philip represents. She depicts him through his house, his work. He's the puppet master. And the fear he instills in others. Last week, I spoke about the Gothic setting of the uncle's house. Uncle Philip's character is drawn in the spirit of the archetypal Gothic villain. So in a way, Carter is assuming that she doesn't need to tell his story, because we would recognize him when we see him. Instead, the story is told about those who are affected by him, those characters whose lives depend on his. Aunt Margaret, his wife, is a silent woman. She lost her voice on her wedding night. She lost her voice because of him, and he maintains control over her through violence and financial dependence. She doesn't keep any of the money she gets from the shop. Wolf tells us that, oh, look. Although we know he's handsome in real life, that's my idea of a really, really, really evil man. Wolf tells us that the looking glass vision of supreme importance, because it charges the vitality, is of supreme importance because it charges the vitality. It stimulates the nervous system. Take it away and man may die. In Uncle Philip's household, Aunt Margaret is emaciated. Her shrunken figure is in stark contrast to his obese and bloated figure. If he looks to her physique for confirmation that he is superior, then indeed he sees himself twice her size, twice as grand as her. Aunt Margaret is feeble, gentle, and caring to the point of self-sacrifice. Uncle Philip is, of course, the other extreme. He's monstrously powerful, oppressive and violent, almost inhuman. He operates under the spell of that illusion, to use Wolf's words, that he is the superior being in the household, and that's what gives him his self-confidence. In the world that Carter depicts, Wolf's observations of gender politics are well illustrated. As long as the wife is silent, as long as she is frail, obedient, and financially dependent, he can be loud, he can be strong, he can be oppressive, he can be controlling. In Carter's novel, anger, fear are the controlling emotions. Uncle Philip's anger is never really explained, except in one scene. When he expresses his indignation at Melanie's father, whom he considers unmanly, lacking in masculine traits. Do you remember the scene when Uncle Philip is doing the dress rehearsal for Leda and the Swan play? And he says this to Melanie, "I never could abide your father. He thought himself too good for the flowers by a long chalk he did. A writer, he called himself, soft bastard. He never got his hands dirty." "But he was awfully clever," protested Melanie. "Not so clever, he thought, to put a bit by to take care of you lot when he'd gone. And so I've got his precious kids, all for my very own, haven't I, to make into tiny little flowers." In this exchange with Melanie, Uncle Philip articulates his definition of masculine behavior by reading himself in opposition to Melanie's father. Unlike Melanie's father, who was an intellectual, not working with his hands, and who did not save money, Uncle Philip, the worker, the breadwinner, is the successful male who gets to keep the children and mold them into his own. That's his definition of masculinity. By referring to Melanie's father in this way, Uncle Philip emasculates him. The father then, if the father's image is the looking glass. The father here then occupies this feminine position. He is the looking glass, and Uncle Philip sees himself reflected in him twice as big. So do you see what I've done with Wolf's ideas about how a patriarch needs to look, see himself larger, bigger than those he dominates? But what I've done here is I have analyzed the feminine position as not a gendered position. The feminine position is just the subordinated position, which can be occupied by both men and women. In this instance, it's occupied by Melanie's father because his behavior does not conform to what Uncle Philip perceives as a traditional masculine attribute. Does that make sense? So when we're reading these theorists, we mustn't immediately associate man with masculine and female with feminine. These are positions that theoretically either gender can occupy. And in week 5, when we do Gender Trouble and we do Judith Butler, we're going to see how theorists later on in the 1970s and 80s and 90s try to question who actually occupies these masculine and feminine positions and how can we blur the distinctions between them. Do you get what I'm trying to do here? So these are not gendered positions. Okay. In Carter's novel, the dominant version of masculinity, the dominant version of masculinity, is one where the man oppresses, damages, and controls. It's a violent and unsympathetic portrayal, which is archetypal, but more importantly, which is clearly depicted as archaic. It's outdated. It's old-fashioned. And this is really a very important point. Be careful when you read this novel not to assume that Carter, like the narrator of Wolfe's text, is categorizing all men as patriarchal villains. Uncle Philip is very carefully placed in the narrative within an outdated, derelict setting. Uncle Philip's shop is antiquated. His house is in ruins. His opinions are out of touch with the London that Melanie can see from her window. Uncle Philip's world is incompatible with the changing landscape of London. Do you remember the scene where a wealthy customer, an American customer, tries to pay by check? She buys lots of Christmas presents, and she tries to pay Melanie by check. And Melanie tells her that only cash is accepted in Uncle Philip's shop. And she says, gee, I think it's charming, because she's American. It suits your old-fashioned kind of shop, kind of Dickensian. How was that? Good. Okay. So this reaction is important. Carter clearly locates the character of Uncle Philip in a distant setting. This guy belongs to, you know, Dickensian era. He is anachronistic, and therefore it makes sense that he must be destroyed. So in order to liberate Aunt Margaret and the rest of the family, Carter knows that this home, this ancestral home that he's built, has to be burnt, and she does burn it. She burns the house down. Aunt Margaret can have money now. That's what we are told at the end of the narrative, and be financially independent. Like Wolfe's narrator, Aunt Margaret can be free if she has, what Wolfe says, the freedom to think of things in themselves. That's a beautiful quote. To think of things in themselves, meaning to have her own opinions. Meaning, and what Wolfe is trying to say, is that in order for women to achieve independence, when a proposition is given to them, when they need to think about a social problem or a social issue, they mustn't be thinking with received ideas that they have been socialized into. So when they are faced with a problem, they need to be able to think of things in themselves, to make up their own opinions about things. That is a very painful process if you have been subordinated and told how to think all your life. Does that make sense? That's sometimes not achieved by many people, the ability to think of things in themselves. Okay. So the toy shop was the space of patriarchy. It was the locus of oppression, and it represented the antithesis to the room of one's own. And its burning signifies a release from that particular form of oppression. It's not the end of all the problems. It is just the release from that particular form of oppression. The uncle burns and he's not there. That's all it symbolizes, really. It's just that space has symbolically exploded now. Of course, what is unclear from Carter's novel is what happens next. And this is really my main critique, but it's also a point of interest in the novel. Carter's novel identifies the source of oppression and fleshes out its components. The burning house at the end leaves an enduring image in the reader's mind, but the novel does not quite offer an alternate space, a space for the, so to speak, emancipated characters. What will happen to the Red family? What will happen to Melanie? The novel offers no options. Wolfe writes that anything can happen when womanhood has ceased to be a protected occupation. And I can see why Carter would have agreed with this proposition. But what I cannot see in this particular novel is an attempt to imagine a feminine space. We don't see it in this novel. We see it later on in Carter's fiction. But we don't quite see it here yet. Okay, so I want to move on to De Beauvoir. Right? I'm moving on to De Beauvoir because I think that De Beauvoir attempts to answer some of the concerns I have raised about Carter and Wolfe. The opening lines of her essay on myth and reality identify her project as one that aims to reconcile myths about femininity with the reality of women's lives. This is something that Carter articulated in that famous quote that I showed you last week, which I will come back to in a minute. So what she's aiming to do is reconcile myths about femininity with the reality of women's lives. De Beauvoir suggests that myths about femininity fix the roles that women can play and therefore renders their existence static and unchanging. Once you've got that, those are your specific roles that you can play, your life becomes static. There's nowhere else you can go. You're born, you're a good daughter, then you get married, you're a good mother, then you remain a good wife, and then when your husband dies, hopefully you wear black, mourn for him until you die, and that's a good woman. So that makes your life quite static, quite predictable and unchanging. So to think that woman exists as the opposite of man, De Beauvoir says, makes woman unchangeable and static because you're always reading her as the opposite of man. And this is really the idea of the eternal feminine that really pervades this essay that you read. I think I'll spend a bit of time explaining this concept. The eternal feminine, or that vague and basic essence, femininity, is a myth. You see that word essence? That's an evil word. Essentialist thinking is evil thinking. Essence means something really barbaric, which is that we are born with an essence to femininity, an essence to masculinity, and that's all we will ever be. So essentialist reading of gender are bad readings of gender. You understand why? Okay. So the eternal feminine is a vague and basic essence of femininity, and that is a myth. The set of attributes that society dictates that all women follow, all women perform, are mythical attributes. The myth of the eternal feminine takes many forms, de Beauvoir tells us. For example, the sanctity of the mother, the purity of the virgin. These are all the myths that society presents to us as part of the eternal feminine. So the sanctity of the mother, the purity of the virgin, these myths serve to deny women's individuality and to trap them inside unrealizable roles, roles that are very difficult for anyone to live up to. Look at what she says. Thus, against the dispersed, contingent, and multiple existences of actual women, against what real women's lives look like, mythical thought opposes the eternal feminine, unique and changeless. So actual lives are never like this eternal, idealized feminine. Actual women exist in multiple roles, but the myth of the eternal feminine constrain them. De Beauvoir warns that the myths of the eternal feminine are so powerful that if a woman's behavior contradicts or challenges them, then we are told that femininity is a false identity, but that the women concerned we are not told that femininity is a false identity, but that the women concerned are not feminine. So if any woman tries to defy these myths of eternal feminine, we're just told, well, she's not a woman. She's not a real woman. So in the first part of her essay, she sets out to debunk the myth of the eternal feminine, a myth that is based on essentialist reading of women and which has no equivalent for men. There is no eternal masculine, she says. And she points out that there is no essence to gendered identity. There is only experience. You are not born into a gendered identity. You acquire it. And this is why she says, on ne n'est pas femme, on le devient, which has been wrongly translated, in my opinion, to one is not born a woman, one becomes one. And I think the literal translation is more like one is not born woman, one becomes it. It's a status. It's a position that you occupy. It is a position that you occupy. You don't become one, meaning one particular woman. This dictum represents her understanding of femininity as based not on essence, you're not born with it, but on experience. And so, de Beauvoir explains that if man fails to discover the essence of femininity, it is simply because it does not exist. So this debunking of the essentialist myths attached to gendered identity becomes even more relevant when we think about Western myths, which have dictated gender roles over the centuries. And this is a concern that is manifested in Carter's Magic Toy Shop. In the Magic Toy Shop, and certainly in all subsequent novels and short stories, Carter examines the myth that society perpetuates, that society imposes on women. Last week, I showed you this quote about how we were truly asking ourselves questions about the nature of reality, etc. In this quote, Carter expresses concerns similar to de Beauvoir's. She stresses the importance of separating reality from myth, because myths are artificial constructs that regulate lives. In the Magic Toy Shop, the myth of Leda and the swan is used as a narrative device, a motif to represent a particular relationship between Uncle Philip and Melanie. He is the puppet maker and the puppeteer. She is his puppet, who has to perform a role prescribed to her by the myth, not by him. The myth is there. We all should recognize it, hopefully, when we read the text or look it up. And so when we know she's going to perform in that story, Carter doesn't give you a synopsis of the myth. The assumption is you understand that she's going to perform the role that's dictated to her by the myth. In this role, Melanie cannot improvise. She cannot react. She cannot revise her character. She is meant to be the beautiful, the passive puppet who must submit to the will of the puppeteer. In the novel, no one can save Melanie from the role that now Uncle Philip prescribes to her because he's supposed to be the puppet maker. And as the puppet maker, he even goes so far as to suggest that Finn lay with Melanie on the same night as the performance would take place so that the myth would be fulfilled. In the myth, of course, Leda is visited by Zeus, who disguised himself as a swan on the same night that her husband had lain with her. Do you see the anticipation? It's quite a controlling setup. So the question here is, how could Carter's use of myth be interpreted here? Well, de Beauvoir explains that enforcing myths is a way of self-justification for patriarchy, very similar to Wolf. So the enforcing of myth is a way for self-justification for patriarchy. She says, through the myths, this is de Beauvoir, through the myths, this society imposed its laws and customs upon individuals in a picturesque, effective manner. Through such intermediaries as religions, you see where she positions religions? Through religions, traditions, language, tales, songs, movies, the myths penetrate even into such existences as are most harshly enslaved into material realities. These myths penetrate material realities. They become part of the real fabric of life. Carter's use of myth, of the myth of Leda and the swan, is an example of intertextuality. Remember from last week? Intertextuality. She refers to the myth in order to, of course, debunk it, to show that Uncle Philip is attempting to indoctrinate Melanie by forcing her into a performance of the role of the submissive puppet. This performance is there to force Melanie into submission, into adopting what de Beauvoir calls the transcendent idea of femininity, which is in opposition to the reality of femininity. So the reality of femininity is inaccessible because the myths that pervade women's lives force them into performing a particular role of femininity that is this transcendent idea of femininity we have no access to, but it's nonetheless what we're supposed to perform towards. Yeah? De Beauvoir and Carter agree that woman's condition has remained the same through superficial changes. And it's this condition that determines what is called the character of woman. She revels in imminence. She is false. She is contrary. So what do we take away from this? Wolf, de Beauvoir, and Carter agree that women's lives are governed by a paradox of their situation. They belong at one and the same time to the male world and to a sphere in which that world is challenged. Do you see the paradox? That they live within patriarchy, but they also know that this patriarchy needs to be challenged, that the truth about their lives cannot be the only truth about their lives. That is the paradox. So they belong to a masculine world which is around them and to a sphere in which that world is challenged. Shut up in their world, surrounded by the other, they can settle down nowhere in peace. I'm going to explore this further next week, by the way. This is where I'm ending this lecture, in suspense. So in 1967, this is precisely the situation that Carter depicts. Women are stuck. They are stuck in this paradox. It's a situation where women exist in a, so to speak, liminal space, where the male world is all-powerful, but where there seems to be room for challenge. We can burn the house down. There seems to be some room for challenge. Now, what characteristics that challenge will take, I'm going to discuss next week when I do Sixu and Irigaray. And if you thought De Beauvoir was tough, I'll see you next week. Okay? Yeah? Okay, bye.